Hello there, and welcome to Preprints in Motion, a podcast taking a deep dive in the fast-paced world of preprints.
Join us as we sit down with early career researchers, discuss their latest preprint, and find out about their journey through the muddy marshes of academia.
Hit that subscribe button, leave a rating, and find us on Twitter at MotionPod. Support us by heading over to buymeacoffee.com/preprints. But for now, let's get into the show.
Got something a little bit different this week as we model cell-cell collisions with Pedram, who does an amazing job at explaining the math so much that I could even follow along. Thank you for coming on. It is going to be a really exciting one because...
Thank you for having me.
All stuff that we don't usually cover, which is great. We finally branched out because we tend to cover a lot of... I mean, it's still cell biology, so we're not branching out that much. But we tend to cover a lot of neuroscience and immunology because that's our background. So it's really easy for us to read papers that we know. And I can just make up questions on the spot because I know what I'm talking about. It's easy. It's great. This one, going to be a bit harder for me to do that, but I'm looking forward to this one. I now start each episode with getting the guests to introduce themselves. So if you could introduce yourself and just a bit about what you do in the lab, what you do outside the lab. Who are you? Let's get to know you.
Sure. So my name is Pedram Zadeh. I am a current fourth year PhD student at Johns Hopkins. I work in the Department of Physics, but my research concerns modeling biophysical systems. I work with Dr. Brian Camley, and my work is computational. So my lab is usually my home in front of a computer. I really love it because my favorite activity is take mathematical models and turn them into scientific computing codes and just hit run and simulate the most, you know, things that you cannot do in real life, I can simulate on a computer. And just having that level of control is really nice. You can experiment with whatever you want. Outside of academia, I really enjoy biking and bouldering. So I try to keep myself grounded doing those two activities. And I really like cooking. And people tell me my sourdough bread is pretty decent.
Was that a lockdown hobby? Or were you on those early sourdough bakers?
No, it was definitely a lockdown hobby. My girlfriend's father was really into it. And then I was like, my life is boring. Yours is not. You bake bread, I'm going to start baking bread.
Is your life more exciting? Do you lead a more exciting life now that you bake bread?
It is. It is. It takes a surprising number of days to prepare. It takes about 4 days to get everything rolling. So, you know, it fills up the week pretty nicely outside of work.
It's surprising how many scientists boulder. It seems to be like one of the biggest hobbies among scientists. Maybe it's the thinking part, problem solving.
That's true. I also wonder if it is just a recent exercise that has picked up. Like previously, you wouldn't be able to watch bouldering competitions. You could only like somewhat watch it on YouTube, and it was very unofficial. But then now the Olympics is hosting it. And I think just the word has gotten out in the recent years. And everyone's like, ooh, I want to try this exciting thing out.
I wish we'd kept it a secret. The bouldering walls are full of people on Tinder dates.
I know, right?
Now you go these days.
9 p.m.
Yeah, right, exactly. Because if you don't, you go and you spend 20 minutes waiting to do a route while someone takes a photo of their friend on the first hold, not off the ground, pretending like they're like 20 feet up in the air.
When you're sub-average like I am, you know, you don't have the confidence to just tell everyone, it's my turn. You wait until it clears out.
So, science. This preprint is all about cell-cell contact. And the thing that got my attention was it was tweeted out with a little animation of two cells colliding toward each other, which I thought was fun. We really do need to stop choosing preprints that are visually interesting, though, because it's the wrong medium. But people can go on Twitter, we'll include it in the show notes, and they can go watch the cool little bit of them colliding together. I wish we could do that with real cells. That would be a cool thing to do. Maybe we can. Maybe we'll find out. So could you tell us a little bit about the background to the preprint? Why were you virtually throwing cells at each other?
Sure. So I would start by saying that we work in the field of collective cell migration, which means we're interested in not just what a single cell does in isolation, but what a group of them do together. And an important aspect of that is cell-cell interactions and trying to understand that. From a chemical, biological perspective, that is very complicated. A lot of molecular machinery is involved, and trying to decode that one by one is just very difficult. What we aim to do is we aim to look at macroscopic behavior and try to model those from a more physical mechanical point of view. In particular, what got us super interested in trying to ask whether the shape of the cell would have an impact in what happens when two cells collide was because of a recent experiment done by Sharina Jain's group, which is actually part of Ben Ladue's group. What they did is they ran two epithelial cell trains together, and they collected a bunch of statistics on the pre-collision quantitative metrics, and they saw what happens when these trains collide with each other. One of the interesting things they found is that the train whose leading cell had a sharper lamellipodium protrusion, so it had a sharper membrane edge entering the collision, that guy was more likely to stay persistent and cause the other cell train to flip. So in our language, and to just make things easier for myself, I will define winning as you remaining persistent throughout a collision. So if you have one cell hitting another cell, the cell that wins is going to be the cell that maintains its previous direction of motion and causes the other cell to turn. In this language, the experiments found that the cell that was flatter had a higher chance to win. And we were interested to say, okay, we know that geometry of confinement, for example, plays a role in how cells behave. Could it be that geometry of contact is now playing a role in determining the outcome of cell-cell collisions? And I'll even go one step further. We already know that geometry of contact does influence intercellular interactions. There is this beautiful paper from the Desai group that considers contact inhibition of locomotion, which is essentially the idea that when two cells come near each other, they don't like to penetrate one another. So they're like, oop, I'm going to reverse my direction and move away from you. That's contact inhibition of locomotion. And the Desai paper experimentally showed that whether you have a head-to-head collision or a head-to-side collision or a head-to-rear collision, that changes the outcome of how likely it is for you to actually undergo this contact inhibition of locomotion. So there is experimental work that suggests geometry of contact and geometry of confinement play a role. And we were interested to ask whether that particular topic would have an impact on the outcome of collisions. And so that's why we're running cells together.
Geometry of contact is basically the angle that cells hit each other, I guess, right?
Yes. In our language, yes. We have simplified it to just that one quantitative metric, which is the good old-fashioned contact angle that comes from the field of liquid droplets.
So this group that were doing actual real-life colliding of cells, how do you do that? You just shoot cells at each other.
The interesting thing is, because running cell collision experiments is difficult, what people often do is they try to confine the cells as much as they can in one-dimensional assays. And so what the Jain group did is they had created these circular confinements, and they had reduced it in the Z dimension, so it was effectively taking place on the plane, where the cells wouldn't like get lifted off the plane. And they were adhered to only this one strip of circular confinement, and they just observed them undergoing collision there.
Okay, I'm kind of imagining a very small Large Hadron Collider with cells.
Almost. Yeah. Where the width of the channel is the width of the cell, so they can't go past each other. They have to collide.
So I'm going to come back to cells actually in collisions, but could you give us an overview, turning math speak into speak I will understand, of the model you used and sort of how you came about, why you chose the parameters you chose in the model?
Sure. So the model we chose, the fancy term for it is phase field. And all that means is that it's actually a borrowed idea from the material science world. It allows us to model a boundary, essentially. And that means we get to have a smooth boundary that deforms smoothly over time, which is nice when you think about cells, because that's what cell boundaries do in real life. In the language of modeling, there are a few things you can do. You can consider a cell just as a point particle. And you can say, I'm just going to give you an equation of motion for this one point. We didn't choose that model because we explicitly wanted to model the boundary of the cell shape, and reducing the cell to a single point would not have accomplished that. On the other side of the spectrum, you can take a phase field model that allows you to have a discussion about the boundary of the cell and incorporate into it biochemistry. So that would be like bring in your biochemical interactions. You can make it as complicated as that. But for sake of simplicity, we did not do that. What we've done is take the simplest form of the phase field model we can, which is to say, hey, I have this boundary, and I'm going to evolve this boundary using energetic terms. That means we say what happens in real life, we'll convert it into energy terminology for ourselves. So cells like to adhere to each other. Energetically, we make them likely to stick to one another. So if two Facebook come close together, the energy cost of actually being near one another is negative, which means it's favored. So they'll do that. Cells don't penetrate one another. So we say, hey, if you're about to go over another one, we penalize you heavily, which means, okay, don't do that. And all of this is because physical systems like to evolve towards the most minimum state of energy. So leveraging that notion, we get to take a complicated biological macroscopic behavior and translate it into energy terms. And so that is what underlies the simulation, is a set of energetic interactions. Another important one I should mention is the way the cell interacts with the substrate, which in our case is just a simple one-dimensional line, is also through energetics. There is in particular a strength of cell substrate adhesion. And the larger that value is, the more the cell wants to spread. And this you can think of as a liquid droplet wetting on a surface. This is in part why the title has wetting in the language, is because we literally take that idea alongside defining the contact angle and tell ourselves, hey, but over this substrate.
That was brilliantly done, because I looked at all the math in your paper and it scared me.
Thank you.
But that was brilliant. That you've summarized a lot of complex stuff there really well.
Thank you.
Substrate was something I was going to come on about, because obviously the substrate is going to have an impact on that cellular behavior. So as with the real life experience, it seems quite constricted. How applicable do you feel all of this is to what happens in the body, for example?
Ooh, that's a hard question for me. I would say that cells move in the body through very narrow confinements. And along those confinements, they come in contact with each other. So if we can understand what happens when they meet each other in confinement, then that adds value in trying to understand things such as how do cells become cancerous cells and decide that it's time to invade other cells? Or how do they decide that it's now time to move collectively to close a gap, which would be wound healing? So I think that is where our value add comes from.
When you're thinking about creating these models, how much do you rely on already done wet lab experiments? And how much do you rely on distilling things down, as you said, to try and make it simple as possible and where you can really get something useful out of it? Because I imagine those two things kind of contrast and combat each other a little bit at times with modeling.
Right. I think it depends on what it is exactly that you're trying to get out and model. For instance, from experiments, we know that when cells come together, the cell-cell contact is actually mediated by a slew of chemical interactions that take place at the cell membranes. One notorious one that controls the cell polarity that I know of is the RhoGTPase proteins that get involved, the RAC and the Rho. One thing you could do is say, I want a model that is faithful to that experimental observation. And so you will then say, I need to have now a complicated model that involves biochemistry, which means I'm going to define these molecules and then I'm going to have concentrations for them and I'm going to end up solving a partial differential equation inside the cell, trying to model what happens in reality with these proteins. You can then say, I don't want to do that at that fine scale. Instead, I just want to take the macroscopic behavior and use a simpler model to explain that, which is something we have done. Our polarity is the most complicated thing you can imagine, is a two-dimensional vector. And this vector, we just tell it to move in a certain direction based on how the cells are in contact. So for example, the reason our cells turn away from one another is because we tell it, hey, if the two heads are meeting, the polarity should point away, right? That is taking a simple model to explain a more difficult biochemical interaction. So to answer your question, I think it depends on what it is that you're trying to answer at the end of the day. In addition to that, I would say that as theorists, you like to take complicated things and try to explain them with the simplest approaches, because the idea is the more complicated a model is, usually the better you can explain data, because that just means you have more knobs to tune and you can fit your parameters more nicely. But the real value is if you can answer the important questions using a simple model, because it is more intuitive and you can explain it better. And I think that is what we try to do, is try to say, how simple can we get to really get down to the nitty-gritty essential ingredients and strip out the higher level non-essential ones when it comes to explaining macroscopic behavior.
That kind of reminds me of something I read once when I think it was early in my PhD, where it basically said whenever you approach anything in science, you should always do with the mindset of keeping it as simple as possible,
right,
whilst allowing it to be as complex as it needs to be.
Exactly.
A lot of scientists like to come in and be all complex and do things like the Krebs cycle and then make you remember it.
Exactly.
And regurgitate it in an exam. And then forget it forever.
Right.
So you created this model and you found that contact angle was really, really important. And you ended up with 70 or 80% of being able to predict the outcomes correctly, which
sounds
good. How do you know if that is a good result or not? Is it just because, I mean, how do you know it's done it correctly?
We claim that it's a good result because it is statistically significantly far from random guess, which would be at 50%. But I think that's as much of a strong claim as we can make, because we would like experimentalists to potentially test this theory and see whether this is actually a sufficiently predictable factor in real life experiments. I should add that our results make it explicit that the specific language of the modeling we've chosen is important. We have outlined why it is we believe that the contact angle is important under the particular front-front contact repolarization mechanism that we have picked. And the question is, we are not saying contact angle will be important no matter what. We're saying that, hey, we found this particular modeling language, which makes contact angle an important predictor. We would be super interested to see if this holds in real life.
Is this something collaborators would look at, or is this something other people in your lab group would look at? Or are you just a purely computational lab?
No, we are a purely computational group, but we have very nice friends in the realm of experiments that would be glad to help us. I believe we are in discussion with a Ladue group that did the original experiments. We want to see if they're excited in any of our results and if they think that whatever we've come up with could potentially be integrated into future experiments. We also have a collaboration with the main group in Virginia Tech. And that one, we're able to run cells together, but they're suspended on nanofibers, however. So it's a bit of a different geometry. But the collaboration is there, which hopefully means that if there is sufficient interest, an experiment could be carried out. Obviously, I would love it if an experiment got carried out, because there's nothing better than saying, hey, I modeled this, we found this, and look at it. Experiments showed it. Like, that's the ultimate conclusion.
It sounds like a lot of the way physicists work, right? Where you've got this split between theorists and people actually
right.
And try and put the theory into practice. It's a really cool approach. It's not something I've come across. I mean, it's immunology. There's not a lot of modeling necessarily, unless you're at the epidemiological kind of stale. But it's not something I've come across much in my scientific career. And it's a really interesting thing to see, because it's such a cool and, for me, different way of doing things.
Yeah, it's really nice. Sometimes I would be presenting and a group of experimentalists would tell me, but this doesn't make sense because we can't do this, or like, this is inaccessible experimentally. And at that moment, I'm just like, I love the fact that I can, you know, explore all these possibilities numerically, because maybe I'll be able to tap. I mean, sure, I'll be tapping a lot of unphysical realms. I'll try not to do that by doing some, you know, pen and paper calculations beforehand. There's no value in doing unphysical simulations. But there's also the chance that I'll be able to tap, you know, a physically realistic regime that just wasn't accessible experimentally. One of them that we actually managed to point out in this paper is that, to my knowledge, when you do experiments and you report your results, you just say, we did these experiments with these configurations and these were our results. But what we actually came up with is, because we were able to change three fundamental cell attributes in an orthogonal fashion, we were able to show that you actually have to have changes in a particular one to discern between our two polarity mechanisms. So I can go into more details, but to keep it broadly speaking, we changed three parameters. If you only change two of them while holding the other one fixed, you would see that both contact angle and speed have a similar say in what happens in the collision outcomes. But it was that third parameter, in particular, the tension of the cell, that really allowed us to discriminate between these models and pick out what was a correlating variable and what was a predicting variable. So I think that level of, you know, scale when you're doing numerical experiments is just a value add that could hopefully convince the group of experimentalists to then say, okay, there's something interesting here. Let's spend the effort to see if it holds experimentally.
It's also the thing that's really hard to do experimentally. I guess the big, yes, the fun part of that is that you also get to wind up a room full of people who see you do something that's really cool and then can't actually do it in real life.
Yes, that's true. For me, is change one value. It's you know, three strokes of a keyboard, but experimentally it is very difficult to change just the tension of the cell without anything else.
One of the questions I had is cell size, I assume, would have an impact in this. Cause I imagine like sort of a mini versus a truck on a road, right? The truck's going to plow straight through a mini. So is this something you've looked at? Is this something that you've thought about looking at?
No, we have not actually done that. And that is an interesting point. I would say that you are correct. I would predict that under our front-front contact repolarization model, I would predict the bigger cell to remain more persistent. Well, actually, the fatter cell will be less persistent. And I believe this is because the reason that contact angle matters has to do with how far your polarity has to sweep through the continuum of angles to reach its target direction. And the fatter the cell is, the higher up its center of mass will be, which means that the way we have defined our repolarization direction will inevitably allow for a smaller sweep of angles. So the rate at which the repolarization happens for a fatter cell would be faster than that for a smaller cell. So perhaps that is actually an interesting to try, because it is the counterintuitive result.
There you go. I'm just giving you more work.
Yes, thank you. I do need another question.
I mean, the other question very much related to that is things like how rigid the cell membrane is, because cells don't all have the same rigidity. Some are quite soft and pliable. Some are quite tough and not so pliable. Is this something you could model? Because that would be quite an interesting thing to look at. Biologically, you're getting into things like actin dynamics here, which would be quite a lot, I imagine, a more complex element. So I think that would be an interesting thing to potentially look at.
Right. So one of the claims we made is that the tension of the cell is actually made up of two components. One of them would be the lipid membrane tension that you get, and then the other would be the cortical actin that's present. We kind of just brushed on that and said, hey, we're just going to let one variable denote the tension of the cell. And we don't know the fine level of details to discriminate between the two contributing factors. So I would say that the tension of the cell, which is one of the main parameters that we sweep through in our experiments, is supposed to model that, the membrane tension. Is that what you were referring to? Are you looking for like a more detailed discrimination between the two types of tension?
I'm happy.
Okay.
So bringing it broader out a bit to just general modeling, because modeling in biology is really, really cool. And it's one of those things I'm not super familiar with. And I think because I don't know what like the audience composition is in terms of pure biology modelers. I know we've got one person at least who listens who models things. Yeah, shout out to Liam, co-author on some of my papers actually. But during COVID, we found that modeling, certainly at the beginning of COVID, was, well, two factors with modeling actually to talk about in COVID. Firstly, it was really, really important because it informed a lot of the decisions that led to things like lockdowns. They were all based on modeling data. And the other thing to mention about COVID and modeling, the early stages, was that everyone seemed to be doing it. Everybody had a model during the first sort of 2 months of COVID, and they modeled everything. And a lot of them, to be totally honest, were total crap. And they were never heard from or seen again. So obviously modeling is really, really important. And I think you've touched upon part of the reasons why it's so cool and important, because you can do stuff we can't actually do in the lab. But you can also do it quicker than we can do. Like, you know, if we were to model the population response to COVID, for example, you can't just come up with that data. You have to wait for the population to get COVID before you can run those what's it actually spreading like kind of experiments. And that's obviously not something you want to happen ever really, but particularly in a pandemic. And that's where modeling comes in to save the day. How do you think COVID has changed the modeling field within biology, if at all?
I'm not sure if I can give a good answer just because I haven't kept up with the modeling world due to COVID. I've been watching 3 Blue, 1 Brown, and whatever he does is as much as I know. I would take the question more broadly just to be able to give an answer and say that when you do modeling, it does provide you with a very powerful tool because you can run things fast and you can explore things in a broader sense. But that also comes with a little caveat, which is, as you mentioned, a lot of people can put models together and claim that X, Y, and Z is the truth, but you really have to interrogate whether that underlying model is accurate. And that is somewhere where, you know, hopefully as scientists, you strive to make sure that your model ticks all the fundamental boxes before you claim some results. So for example, if you're modeling a billiards game, you don't have your balls just jumping off the table, right? That's not a good model if your model just has spontaneous balls going everywhere.
It's how I play the game.
Yeah, okay. That's fair. So in our work in particular, what I know we've done is there is a tool that allows you to wet objects on other objects. You define energy terms for it, and it's a state-of-the-art software that is like well-published, and people take it as the ground truth out there. And we ensured that our wetting results exactly match one-to-one to that ground truth. Does that mean that there can be no bugs in the code I've written? No, but you know, I've done whatever I could in the last 3 years to make sure that all the wrinkles are ironed out. And then that goes to what you guys are doing, which is opening up science, because it says, hey, everyone see what I did and, you know, let me know if I did something wrong. So I would say modeling is a super powerful tool, but it comes with the responsibility of ensuring that, you know, there is some baseline level of integrity established for it before you jump into your super exciting question that you want to answer with it.
Which is, I mean, it's a good way of approaching any science, is to actually read and understand the limitations and the strengths of what you're doing, which right. I think quite a lot of scientists forget to do. We kind of look at the headline, even though we also complain about the headlining of science. We take that a bit too often. So take somebody like me, whose math skills are so poor, I once made a blocking solution 1,000 times stronger than it needed to be because I read the scales wrong. Fun fact, it blocked the hell out of my sample and nothing bound. So if I'm approaching a paper where there's some modeling in, doesn't matter what kind of modeling that is, and I want to try and understand if that model's good or not, what would you suggest I look at? Because you mentioned in your work, you know, you were very careful with how you define things. And this is something I found in my own work, actually, some of the code work I did. We were very careful with the wording we used and how we defined what we did, because that does matter, right? It does impact how you interpret the data. So do you have any tips for somebody like me to assess a model?
I would say the thing you want to look for is, how are the results of that model? How do they compare with either baseline truths that we know from somewhere else? Or how do they compare with experimental observations that aren't necessarily the truth, but there's at least someone else under some other setting has observed this? Then you'll have the case of a set of models that are just out in the wild and they're predicting unseen, unheard of things. In that regime, I don't know if there's anything you can do other than just say, okay, well, this is a nice idea. We should hopefully see if someone else can run experiments that corroborate this or not. And I would say, if the modeling is in that realm where it doesn't have any ground truth, any baseline to fall upon and say, hey, we observed X, we modeled X, then it falls onto the modelers to try to really make a case for why others should either run experiments that try to show this is the case, or just, you know, rigorously and mathematically prove why this should be the case.
Which that kind of quite nicely leads us into the whole bit you said just before that about opening up science.
Exactly.
So, you know, I think one of the nice things with modeling is that it is all there. You can download the code, you can go and run it yourself. And if you understand it enough, you could modify it yourself if you needed to.
Exactly. If there's like certain things they didn't do and you think, you know, that was a misjudgment and, you know, they really should have tested this thing, then you can hopefully take their code and do that and convince yourself or them whether the thing is right or wrong.
Certainly the past few months has been a big movement in the open science field in terms of things like coding, actually, but also like the metadata behind papers. And there's a lot of stuff going on at the minute that seems to just being pushed lately. I did a paper where we looked at differences between preprints and papers. And as part of that, we were looking at things like, was the supplemental data changed? And one of the interesting things we found is that when a paper was published, that supplemental data often disappeared, as in, the link was there, but when you clicked on that link, you just got sent back to the paper. So in effect, the data just disappeared from existence. And one of the things I've heard a lot is that code isn't necessarily shared brilliantly, or it isn't necessarily annotated very well all the time. As someone working in that field, how do you feel about the sharing of code? Do you think, I mean, I think it can always be done better, but how do you think it currently is?
So I haven't touched other people's code all that much. And that is mostly because of my personal issue, which is I need to write the thing myself. Otherwise, I don't understand what I'm doing.
Yeah.
But it might also be because, on average, the scientific researcher who writes code doesn't write well, you know, doesn't write a well-written software package. And what I mean by that is, you know, like nice documentation explicitly telling you how to set up your environment so you can run things in exactly the same way they had run it. It is by far not sufficient to just hand someone the code that you ran, because you know the assumptions that went in it. You know the 3 years of history that went into it. And, you know the little flags you left for yourself, but others don't. And it's, in my experience, it has been much more productive for me to just understand the idea and code it up myself than to take someone else's code. Now, I'm trying, when we hopefully get this paper out alongside the code repository, I am fortunate enough to have some level of experience with software engineering. So I'm trying my best to give out as nicely done a package as I can with explicit instructions on how people should run it and what exactly to run to get which of the figures, as well as all the assumptions that have gone into the production of this code. But, you know, again, when people just write code for the sake of getting a figure out or an idea published, they don't usually spend time fixing the code in terms of writing an optimized, well-documented code base, because that is not their job. Their job is to get that nice-looking figure and write the paper. But I think it is important to see if, you know, it is actually to consider whether it is time well spent publishing good repositories. Because you never know, maybe in a few years, your new question could leverage your previous work. And it would be much nicer if, you know, you have a nice, working, clean code base as opposed to a hot mess that you wrote 4 years ago and you forgot what it does now.
A hot mess describes how I code when I
rarely
code. It's a mess. It's So we had Liam and Nick on our COVID work who did all the coding, really. I just filled in for a couple of odd figures. And, I mean, they were both really, really good at doing well-documented code. Like, it was good enough that I could teach myself R and follow along with what they were doing. Mine was terrible. So whenever we put anything I coded, they basically just redid it. I have, just to reinforce what you're saying about that, though, I've come across a couple of examples in the literature where there's been really well-documented code, and it is hugely appreciated as someone who wants to use that or even just understand what's been done. And I think the effort is well spent. And I think it's also, we could expand out into all methods in papers. I think they're all, at the moment, very badly reported. I've picked up many papers and I've tried to replicate the methods in the lab and not been able to. In fact, there was Brian Nosek did a paper, came out in December last year, looking at the cancer field on reproducibility. And they had huge issues reproducing lab data, in part because methods weren't very well explained. A lot of cases, they had authors who just didn't help them, who were unhelpful or didn't respond. I think it's an area science can generally pull ourselves together a bit and do better in.
You know, the old saying that you can only teach to others what you've understood yourself the best. I wonder if that also plays a factor here, where, like, if you aren't able to write a well-documented, well-written method section, does that mean that you didn't really understand what you did either?
That explains how my code turns out as a hot mess, because I don't necessarily understand what I'm doing, so I can't necessarily document it brilliantly. But that actually may very well.
I was going to say, I do also think, like, the methods, at least for scientific papers, you get a word limit on it. Like, you're trying to write an intro, your methods, your results, and obviously the methods is what is kind of classed as the least important bit. So you cut that way down and give, like, the basics. And I would much rather give, like, have no word limit on my methods and give a really detailed account of what I've done. But if you're writing it, it's in the word count and it seems to be the first thing to go.
Is there a reason why it's like this?
Publishers are stupid. I think it's a legacy. It's a legacy thing from when papers were actually printed out and published that way.
Okay.
And it's a space thing, basically. And so it's not just methods. Some publishers, I won't name them, still limit how many references and citations you can have for the same reason. So we end up where you've got a paper that, and you're just not actually able to cite the full literature, which is ridiculous. I should say some publishers are doing a really good job of that, and now they don't have limits on their methods, and they encourage you to be very detailed. PLOS and eLife in particular are both pushing methods and new ways of writing your methods. So eLife now let you tie in the data tables and the code in some cases to so people can read your paper online and come across a figure and the code associated with that figure, and they can run that in line with the article to generate the figure themselves. And
wow,
there are some people pushing that. I think it's a lot more effort on the author's part to submit that kind of stuff, but it's nice to see. I like it. Another shout out to eLife. Actually, they have given us funding, so I can't complain about them the way I do Twitter.
No, I mean, you're absolutely right. The easier you make it on the audience, the more chances that you give them to verify your work as well as engage with your work. So it's really a win-win, mostly for yourself.
Yeah, and I think it's on the author's job is always to make, doesn't matter what you're writing, actually, whether it's science or not science, it's to make the reader's job as easy as possible.
Absolutely.
And yes, that's a bit more work on your part, but like you said, I think you benefit from doing that. And if you've got something accessible, then you're going to get more people who can access it.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, well-written paper is just, like, if I read the first paragraph and I'm like, I can't do this. Like, it's right. Like hardly written, really long sentences. It's so important to have it nice and quick and concise. Well, if you get a paper that flows well, it's just so much easier to read and just so much more enjoyable.
Yeah, I don't read papers anymore for the most part. I just skim the figures because, yeah, I hate reading papers because of the way they're written, mostly. So in terms of preprints, let's live up to our podcast name. Whose idea was it to preprint, and have you had any positive experiences from preprinting this work or previous work?
So this was actually my first paper out there. So it constitutes my first preprint, and it was my advisor's idea to put it on the bioarchive in preparation of submitting it to the journals.
Oh, so you haven't uploaded it at the same time as submission?
Oh, we did. We submitted to numerous places at the same time of uploading it to the bioarchive. It was just to get the idea out there, as well as being able to send an actual link to some of our collaborators to say, hey, this is what we did. Are you interested in, like, you know, please let us know what you think. And also, are you interested in potentially like any collaborations that could come out of this? As well as to get the word out, my advisor's been like super awesome about this. He posted it on his Twitter account, which got a lot of traction, as well as the bioarchive. And he's been really helpful in making sure that we submit it to the journals as well.
We found it through Twitter. I've gotten some really good collaborations out of posting preprints. So it's I haven't heard anyone posting it so they could send it to the collaborators. And that's quite a nice idea. Because it has that little undertone of, oh, look at all the attention it's getting. You should jump on now.
Yeah, the bioarchive has a little flag for the number of engagements on Twitter, which is, I didn't know they do that. So I was like, wow, this is nice. It's like the number of likes on a post.
Yeah, you get, serotonin hit every time. Yeah, the first time we did it, I basically just stayed on that page for about a week straight.
So what have been your positive with the archive world?
I'm very biased. I'm part of ASAP Bio. I'm part of Prelights. I have this podcast. So I do a lot of promoting for preprints and scream about open science a lot. I personally, we've had all papers so far, I think, put up as preprints first. The big one for me was my first senior author paper was the first COVID paper we did. I think partly because it was COVID, partly because it was a really good paper because the team was amazing. Every time I talk about it, I have to say the team's amazing. I really did very little. But that got a lot of attention, and that's why I was on the BBC giving false information out across the airwaves. It got us covered in quite a lot of just magazines and stuff. So the second code preprint we did was actually covered by The Economist and stuff. So it was a really cool way of doing it, and that wouldn't have happened had we not posted them as preprints.
Right.
Because it was at that point where they were picked up. And again, because it was COVID, it was quite timely. So the review time for a journal it took almost a year from the first preprint to it being published in the journal. And so that we would have missed all that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I also imagine with like COVID at that time, the reviewers were probably more strict then.
I don't know if they were quicker. They were definitely quicker. The turnaround times were quicker. That's one of the things we showed in our paper actually. I don't know if they were more strict. One of the things I really wanted to do was to get peer review reports and look at them, and that was way too much effort. But yeah, I mean, I've had a lot of benefits from preprints. We also had someone on once who their whole idea was just their preprint was the final version. So that was it. They never wanted to publish. It was just preprint and the work was out there, which is a really nice thing to do. Our second preprint was designed to be like that, but we picked up a collaborator who actually paid for the publication costs. Because as a postdoc senior author, I don't get any support publish papers and pay publication costs.
Do you envision a world in which archive replaces peer reviewed because people will volunteer?
You're touching on a lot of topics there. I mean, the physics world, right? That's how physics works. In physics, you post on archive, and that is the end goal. You publish as a formality. Mm-hmm. Whereas in biology, it's almost like you preprint as a formality, but your end goal is to publish. The preprint is just a step on that path. We're seeing a lot more people preprint. That COVID helped a lot with that, actually. But also funder mandates are now doing it, so you've got to do open access. And preprinting is by far the easiest way to do that, and cheapest. It's free. Some of the open access costs are a third of my yearly wage. It's obscene. And also a really bad waste of taxpayer and charity money. Just going to throw that out there, make people feel a bit guilty.
Yeah.
But I think it's the way things are going. So we're seeing a lot of community review efforts now. We've got the creator of pre-review on in a 2 weeks' time, I think, who is, I was one of the first sort of preprint review, public review sites. Been a lot sprung up since then. And those are now getting integrated into the more forward-thinking journals. So again, eLife and PLOS, they really should have me on board in a more official capacity at this point. They will accept those community reviews. eLife, for example, only take preprints now. You cannot submit a paper without preprinting it first to eLife. They're the journals to look for if you want to see where science is going to be in, like, you know, being realistic, probably like 10 years' time, if not longer, by the time everyone else catches up. But that's where things are going. You know, Nature now quite open about supporting preprints. Nature covered our work a lot as a preprint and have now subsequently covered preprints a lot. So it's where things are going. It's just going to take a bit of time. And things like, you know, this is partly why we do this, to talk about why everyone should preprint. And ASAP Bio do an amazing job.
They get this awesome experience with you guys.
Yeah. You know, we'll have everyone on. Oh, well, we would have everyone on. And, you know, I get to ask all the stupid questions, and I love doing that. This is the best thing I do in science at the minute. I have a lot of fun doing these.
I mean, sometimes the easiest questions lead to the most interesting discussions, right? So that's great. Engage everyone.
Yeah. I think it helps the author sometimes to step back from their work and just
absolutely
think about it more broadly. Because often when you're doing the work, you get so caught up in it. It's kind of difficult to do. But the other thing we get to do that is a lot of fun here is we also talk about you as an early career researcher, because I think the other thing that preprints are really good at is highlighting and benefiting early career people. And we like to show that there are people behind the work. We're not just all work 17 hours a day in the lab and then sleep in the lab and then put our hammock and tent away and get back to work. We do have lives. We quite like to talk about, we ask you these questions when we give you the guest form to fill out and stuff to help us guide our questions. One of the things you said is that you were thinking about going into industry after your PhD. And this is one of those conversations I've had a lot lately with people we've just had a PhD student start, and her whole aim is to do her PhD and then go into industry. And there was an article in Nature recently looking at the question of this perceived lack and difficulty in recruiting postdocs. And so I'm very interested in why people are kind of leaving academia, I guess. I'm also leaving, and there's so many. But, you know, why did you decide to do a PhD, I guess, if your aim is to potentially go into industry?
Because I love having a research scientific oriented role. And when I'm thinking about leaving academia, I would say not leave academia, because academia is the pursuit of science, right? Is doing scientific work. I would just like to do scientific work at an industry scale, because I like to take the best of the academic world, which is do pure research, be driven by innately fundamentally interesting questions. And I want to take the aspect of the industry, which says you actually now have to make this operational and useful to someone. And that's where I like to end up. So why did I do a PhD knowing I actually knew I want to go into industry well before I applied for a PhD program? So more to your question as to why did you then do a PhD if you knew you were going to leave, is because when I leave, I want to leverage this experience because I want to keep doing scientific work, just not in an academic setting.
I mean, that's kind of what I was hoping you were going to say.
And the reason that I personally don't want to be in an academic setting is mostly just because I don't want to only work in the smallest, most niche area of expertise that, like, you know, I keep citing for the other people for the rest of my life. I would like to work on scientific questions that then go into operational mode. And actually, I can say, hey, look, like, these 10 people are using a product that was developed by my research.
Which is, I mean, it's there are going to be people listening to this who are having those kind of thoughts, and that is a really good, I think that's the same approach that our PhD student who's just started has, actually. It's that she's doing it for the same reasons you just said, and, you know, she knows what she wants to do afterwards, and it's a beneficial thing on that step.
Right.
You also touched upon one of the big reasons I'm leaving, which is that it's that narrow focus. To be successful in academia, you seem to have to focus so narrowly, and your whole life's work is about this one thing, and I hate that. I've got like...
Yeah, I want to know a little about everything.
Yeah, I counted recently, and I have 16 different lab or non-lab-based research projects on the go at the moment. And I think 4 of those are lab-based. The rest are all across meta-research, preprints, open access, the state of academia. And, you know, it turns out that's quite damaging if you want to stay in academia, because people don't want you to split across all those things. So the thing you talk about is sort of the balance between work-life balance that we have in science. So you've got hobbies, as we discussed at the start of the show. Mm-hmm. How do you balance that for yourself? I mean, I guess working from home must help a little bit, because you can go and have nice food for lunch and stuff. You can have a cat right. that you can pet all day.
I have 2 cats, actually. So, yes. Okay, I'll say this. There are 3 reasons. First is my advisor is incredibly nice, and he understands that there is a life to be had outside of academia. And so the most important perspective is the responsibilities and expectations set for me by my advisor. And those are set knowing that I need to have a decent life outside of academia. So that is like the number one reason I'm able to have these hobbies. The second one is my girlfriend actually keeps me grounded. So when it's time to go bouldering and I am trying to debug my code, she's like, I'm going and you're coming, because it's good for your mental health. And then the third is when COVID happened, I realized that I am mostly just either working or playing video games, and that was just not healthy. So I read a book, which I put it out there because I think it's an awesome book everyone should read. It's called Atomic Habits. It just tells you how to form habits, and it's not your, you know, everyday person telling you, oh, just pick up a pen and paper and write things down. And if you didn't succeed at it, it's because you're not good enough. This guy actually like goes through a more scientific explanation as to how you can do this. So I adopted a few ideas from that, and I, you know, wrote down some of the hobbies I like and gave myself a schedule and really tried to stick to it. And after some time, some of them became habits, many of them did not, but there was some level of success there.
There you go. This has been such a nice chat that I've actually lost track of time for once. So I think that's also a good ending point anyway. So I think we'll end it here.
Sure.
I'd just like to say I really agree with all 3 of your points. So I like to try and keep a good work-life balance as well. And a lot of it is due to my supervisor being quite understanding, and it allows me to like do my hobbies, such as like netball and jiu-jitsu, and they're like set times when I have to be there each week. So I'm like, right, that's when I go and I switch off and I'm out of the lab. Otherwise, right, it gets to be a bit much sometimes. You get a bit absorbed and you're right, like, oh, well, I could continue and keep doing this. That type of thing. But
also, as institutions, as academic institutions who want to increase the rate of retention, it's just good to let people know that we value your time.
Yes.
I'm writing a piece about that right now, about why we should have a bit more focus on the individual in academia. Yeah. Feeling valued is, yes.
It's so important.
That long, oh, it's going to get me into so much trouble when that comes out. Worth it. Okay, and that is the show. If you enjoy listening, then hit that subscribe button for more and leave us a review on whatever platform it is you're listening on. You can reach out to us on Twitter at MotionPod or online at preprintsinmotion.com. Didn't enjoy that? Well, we're all scientists here, so send us your review and let us know what works or what you'd like to hear more of, or less of. But until next time, have a good week.
Where do I find out about the different bioarchive licenses? This CC, BY, CDXY nonsense is driving me nuts.
ASAP Bio have a resource for that.
Ugh, that's your answer for everything.
That's because they have everything you need to know about preprints.
Sure, they probably have the basics, like info on the preprint servers, but what else is there?
There's so much more. Looking to post a preprint, but not sure what different journal policies are? They have a collection to help you out with that. There are meetings around preprints and associated services. If you want to know how preprint adoption has changed over time, there's even a page on that.
And COVID?
They have a big section on preprints and the pandemic, plus some really cool infographics for communicating preprints.
And university policies? Surely they don't have that.
They collect uni policies where possible.
Okay, they do sound pretty impressive, but is it not a bit of an echo chamber?
It can be, but ASAP Bio also engage with people who don't love preprints and have concerns. So we had an excellent discussion on this very topic a couple of months ago.
Oh, is there anything ASAP Bio don't do?
Honestly, no, they're so nice over there. They were so quick to jump in and support this show. It's your one-stop shop for info on preprints and open science initiatives. So head over to asapbio.org to learn more and subscribe to their newsletter for the latest in preprint news. If you want a deeper dive into the world of preprints, then look out for the next recruitment of ASAP Bio Fellows.